I wanted to talk to you a little bit about remote voting and the role of the research community and some stuff that I'm excited about, and we'll see if I get you excited too. So right now, voting technology seems to be in a lull. It's kind of in this quiet period where it seems innovation getting adopted seems almost stalled, with a few bright spots here and there. But for us researchers, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe that means now's the perfect time for us to go do some innovative research, because we don't have people breathing down our backs. We can go figure out what the voting technology of the next decade or two ought to look like. And in particular, what I want to do in this talk is I want to give you some of my most wanted, some research problems I'd love to try to persuade you to get excited about in hopes that maybe you'll solve them for all of us. Specifically in the area of remote voting. Okay? So let's start off with probably the most obvious instance of remote voting, at least here in the US. And I apologize if this is US-centric. Vote by mail. So in the western states, like California where I live, we see a significant increase in adoption of vote by mail. Many of the states we see 40 or 50% or even more voters voting by mail. 100%, if you don't count the people who turn them in person. Yeah. All right, but yet vote by mail has a number of, you know, it's not perfect by any means. So let me mention what I think is the first good research challenge for our community is, what can we do to improve vote by mail? The bar here seems pretty low. So just to share with you a couple examples of possible challenges I'd love to see some people work on. One that would be fascinating would be to try to provide voters with an opportunity to get feedback. If you vote in the polling place and you make a mistake, you can easily, you know, correct your ballot, get a new ballot, get feedback if you didn't fill in the ballot right. Voters who are voting from home and voting by mail don't get all the benefits of that. Is there anything we could do from a technology perspective? Another obvious area is fraud or reliability or auditability. If you look at, for instance, just about every case of election fraud in the past, you know, decade or two in the U.S., they pretty much all involve absentee ballots. What can we do about that? And moreover, is there anything we can do to help voters confirm, you know, help check that their vote was received and it was counted correctly? Can we make the process auditable? I think there's some great opportunities here. I've seen some nice work and I'd love to see some more. Let me mention another one. Moving aside from vote by mail, I'm going to call it not quite remote voting, because it's kind of remote voting, but kind of in person. I think it might be time to reconsider the precinct model. When you go in person to vote, you go vote at your precinct. And this is a model that we've had for, you know, it's been around for several centuries, and it kind of derives from this, you know, social neighborhood perspective that I'm going to go to my polling place, and that's a form of community, and my poll workers will know me, and I'll know them because we all know each other. I don't know how true that is today. Maybe in some communities, maybe for some folks, but maybe not for everyone. And folks are a lot more mobile, and this could be pretty inconvenient if you're at work all day and, you know, you're far away from your home polling place. That may actually make it difficult for you to vote. So I'll give you a little analogy here. Imagine if you wanted to drop off outgoing mail, but you were only allowed to drop it off at your own home post office. You couldn't go to any other post office branch. It wouldn't take your mail, right? That'd be crazy. We'd say, what the heck? And yet that's essentially what we've done with voting. We've said you have to go vote at your home precinct, your home polling place. So I think another challenge that we might think about that I think is an exciting one is, can we enable voters to vote from any polling place of their choice? Maybe any polling place in the county, or maybe you could be even more ambitious. And what technology would we need to make that possible? For instance, you know, I start thinking about the implications of that, and what does my mind drive to? It drives to like, okay, oh my gosh, how are we going to do that? We need an internet connection. Every polling place has to be up. What happens if the internet goes down? Can you still vote over in that other polling place? How does that work? I don't know. I don't have the answers. I'd love to start a conversation. Maybe you'll have some answers. And let me mention a second one in this kind of theme here, which is that one message I've been hearing from a number of election officials and others is that many voters like, one thing they like about vote by mail is that they can research their candidates and make all their selections at home and take their time and, you know, really think it through and, you know, do any research they want. And I'm starting to hear that more and more voters would like the opportunity to do this at the time and place of their choosing, maybe even on their smartphones, especially for younger voters. But we know that voting over the internet's risky, so this is a little bit of a scary prospect. So what can we do to help facilitate this to enable voters? I don't know how many years ago Ron Rivest proposed the idea of pre-voting, where you could make initial selections from home, from your computer or your phone or whatever, over the internet. And then, but you were not done there, then you go into the polling place on election day and you can pull up all the selections you previously set up, and then you can have the option to change them if you like or just cast it as is. I think that's a really exciting direction because it helps address some of the challenges of the internet voting. You're there in person. You have a chance to confirm all your votes, but provides a lot of these advantages of being able to, you know, research your selections at the, you know, home, your kitchen table, where it's more convenient. So, but then let's think about what is the technology we need to enable pre-voting. What are the challenges going to be if we try to implement this? How do we make this work? I don't know the answers. I don't even know what I think the big problems are going to be. I'd love to hear from you. And by the way, one reason why I think maybe this is interesting and relevant, for instance, I mentioned a few bright spots of innovation. Los Angeles County is one of them that's considering a new voting system, and at least there's been some discussions that one of the things they're thinking about is, should we maybe try to design a voting system that could support pre-voting? What do we need to do? All right, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. By the way, please interrupt. Don't wait to the end. Share your thoughts. I would love to start a discussion among all of you. But if you don't interrupt, I'll move on to something else. Next topic I'd like to talk about is accessibility. And just to start with a little review of the state of where things stand with access to the polls for voters with disabilities. Something like maybe 15% of the U.S. voting age population self-identifies on the census as having one or more disabilities. So that's, you know, over 30 million eligible voters in the U.S., for instance. That's a significant population. And by the way, probably there's good odds that will be you and me and all of us when we get older because, you know, as our eyesight starts to go, it's not unusual, especially with increasing rates of diabetes and other things that cause low vision. So this is not like a niche area. And if you look at access to the polling place, a GAO study found that, well, depending on how you count it, somewhere between 45 to 72% of polling places have potential impediments to access from getting from the parking place to the polls and using a voting machine. So that's a potential issue. You know, they run out of people's garages and may not always have wheelchair access, and it's difficult to find polling places that are accessible. But even more, if you manage to get into the polling place, then many voters with disabilities are having experience where there's a separate special machine just for voters with disabilities that may not even be powered up or used by anyone else and requires some, you know, different setup procedures, and the poll workers have to know how to set it up. And if you're lucky, maybe they know how to go through all the steps, but if you're not lucky, maybe they don't, and then they're flipping through manuals or calling helplines or trying to figure out how to get this accessible voting machine up and running. So when I look at all these kind of different factors, it seems like there's a whole bunch of things that can go wrong for voters with disabilities when they want to go vote in the polls. And that makes me wonder if we ought to be thinking about ways that we could also enable and help disabled voters to vote from home, so that at least there's multiple options. One thing that we've seen with vote by mail is that vote by mail, political scientists say in the papers I've read, that doesn't really seem to change the turnout numbers, increase the turnout numbers for any identifiable population, except for voters with disabilities. And you can sort of see why that might be, given this background. So I think there's, you know, interesting opportunities here. You look at, for instance, the state of Oregon has their accessible HTML ballot, where you can, it's a pretty simple idea from home, call up on a web browser using your own, whatever your own access technology might be, you know, make your selections, print out a ballot, and send it back. I would love to see some research on how well that works. Does that work well for voters? And are there issues for any categories of voters, like voters with motor impairments, blind voters, you know, ability to see the printout? Is that an issue? Are there other things we could do to help help voters with disabilities vote from home on their own equipment? And the other challenge I'll point you to is one that I've become passionate about, and that's overseas voters, overseas and military voters. And so let me take a minute to tell you a little bit about the state of that in the U.S. In the U.S., estimates are there's something like maybe 6 million eligible U.S. voters abroad, civilian and military. That's a non-trivial percentage of the population. But the statistic that really stands out at me is that if you look at overseas voters who wanted to vote and tried to vote, a recent survey of them finds that 25% of them were not able to. Their vote didn't count. They were disenfranchised, okay? So this, for me, is just a remarkable number. That's 1 in 4. So I want to just take a moment to emphasize this and, like, put a human face on this. Like, I want you to imagine you go to your polling place and imagine that 1 in 4 voters were turned away and were not able to vote, right? Like, that guy there, he gets to the front line, sorry, you can't vote, go home. No, you're not voting either, go home, right? Sorry, thanks for coming, you're not voting today. No, not her either, right? I mean, think about what that would be like, right? If this was the experience around you. I find this distressing. If this was happening at a polling place where I was the poll worker running the polls, right, I'd be almost in tears if 1 in 4 of our voters were, you know, prevented from voting.
So yeah. Of the ones that couldn't vote, what was kind of the breakdown of the root causes? Did they not get their ballots in time? Did they not get their ballots back in time?
The biggest factor was not getting their ballot at all. The next biggest factor was getting the ballot too late. Then there was some smaller set of people who, for instance, had difficulty registering or had a hard time going through the hoops. You know, it's crazy. Like, it's not enough to register to vote. You have to then submit this special form to request a ballot, and then you have to understand when you know how often you need to submit this form, and then there's all these deadlines, and it's a mess. So the biggest one by far, though, is not getting your ballot. And then the second biggest one is getting it too late. So the OVF has a voter survey where they surveyed about, several thousand voters, and they break down the statistics. So you can find it on their website.
I've lived abroad for 11 years. I've never received my ballot. I'm always the only one faxing in my ballot.
Wow.
LA County.
And that brings me to the second statistic from their survey. If you think that, this, we may be disenfranchising a quarter of a voting population, but at least it's safe and secure. The same voting survey found that in 2012, 15% of voters returned their ballot electronically. No paper, not both electronic and paper, solely electronically. And that's almost entirely email. So, I mean, that's got to be about the worst possible way. Like, I don't know anyone who wants to stand up and say, oh yeah, voting by email, sending a PDF and an email, that's totally the way. We should all be doing that. That's a great idea. Right? I mean, come on. So, we've created this situation where we're disenfranchising a large fraction of the population and we're encouraging this really crummy kind of voting method. We're driving people to use it because they have no other choice. All right, so that's the problem set up. And I think there's like a, this is a problem crying out for a technological solution. I'm not the first one to make this argument, obviously. But I will point out that while this, there seems to be some signs of improvement, this problem is not, you know, does not seem to be, from my perspective, on track to getting fixed with our existing solutions. So maybe 4 or 5 years ago, that number instead of being 25% was 30%. Okay, so 30%, 25% sounds good. But you know, keep in mind, this is in 2012. Where after many states have started to deploy blank ballot, you know, electronic blank ballot delivery, which is, you know, and after the MOVE Act has, you know, changed practices in a number of places. So I don't know that there's any easy low-hanging fruit here. So here's the part of the talk that I really wanted to try to, you know, focus on. I want to make a case that I admit will probably be controversial, which is I think we should be studying how to make internet voting work. I think this is maybe the biggest or one of the biggest challenges for our research community. I would love to see a crash effort on how to do this because. What do I mean by work? Well, I guess what I mean by work is at least well enough that we could use it for overseas and military voters and maybe disabled voters. Yeah, okay, granted. And I recognize, this is, so by the way, this is like, yeah, let's make internet voting work was kind of the talk title that I wasn't brave enough to put on the front of my slide or on the website. But this is what I want to argue for, and I want to, yes, Jeremy. Please, please. Okay. All right. I have no response to that. Yeah, about that much. Yes.
Voters with disabilities, where, you know, we want some.
I don't have an answer. I guess the only thing I'll say is right now the overseas military voters do have a second class system. So a system that was better, less second class would be improvement, wouldn't it? I don't have an, but I think there's a serious point there, which is this: if you develop this for one voting population, then it's going to start to get used more widely. There's going to be a clamor for it to be used more widely, and we should recognize and be prepared for that. And I don't have a solution to that. Yeah. By the way, I recognize the irony too, which is that almost 10 years ago, I was saying internet voting is not safe, right? I and others wrote the CERV security report saying this is really dangerous. And yet here I am today saying, it sounds like exactly the opposite. Well, at least let's try to make it safe enough for overseas voters. So maybe one of the questions we should ask is, like, is it even possible? Is there any hope, right? I mean, like, I could be standing up here arguing for we should be studying teleportation, because it would be so cool to have a teleporter, wouldn't it? And yet, that just seems so far beyond what we'd have any clue how to do. So let me try to make a case for why I think there might be some room for movement here. And let's start to get into a little bit slightly more technical. You know, we start from this argument right here, which is making this voting safe is hard because of the competing challenges of the integrity and anonymity. And if only voting weren't anonymous, then it'd be easy, right? Just publish everyone's vote. You know, so have some public website or something that shows, you know, the name of every person who voted and how they voted. Here they're voting on what their favorite ice cream flavor. And then, you know, all these voters, Anne, can go check that her vote was recorded as she wanted, and anyone can go tabulate up the votes. It's all done in public, and, you know, no problem. If only, if not for that pesky anonymity, right? So, I think...
That's not so obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to have a dispute procedure. If you see something published under your name, you've got an authenticated manner to dispute that. And so you've got the issue of authenticated communication arising into this kind of here.
Yeah, you can already, maybe you could tell from the way I was talking that I'm not convinced that it's quite that easy. Yeah, what do I do when I go look on this website and that's not what I wanted? And, you know, what if I look on this website and it's like, oh, that's not totally not what I wanted? You know, I bet you that voters will often forget what they marked and what they wanted. And later, if they go look again, they might decide the second time around, oh no, no, I totally didn't do that, right? So we need to be able to handle, I don't know. Just to cause trouble or discredit an election. Or because they're being coerced. Yeah. All right, so there's obvious. But maybe we could accept that things would be a whole lot easier if it weren't for the anonymity. And so I think that maybe points us to something, which is if the anonymity is the hard part, maybe it's worth thinking for overseas voters, how much anonymity are they getting if we're going to target overseas voters? And hey, you know what? Actually, the level of anonymity that they're getting right now ain't so hot, I got to tell you, right? I mean, it's not terrible, but... at a minimum, if you're an overseas voter, you have to trust your election official. And most overseas voters and most voters are, you know, many are willing to do that. And some overseas voters, it's even worse. Like in the state of California, if you want to, you know, if you didn't get your ballot and you want to vote by fax or something, then you have to sign a privacy waiver, a statement that says, I waive my right to anonymous ballot, right? Already, we are in a situation, now that's horrible, but that's the situation we're in. So if we want to do at least as well or better than the current situation, that's the bar that, you know, the bar is not perfect anonymity in the polling place. The bar is where we're at today. Yes?
You're redefining work.
Yeah, I'm redefining work. Yeah, yeah. Pam, yeah? I'm, well, yep, yep, yeah, that'd be a step forward if we could enable 100% of the overseas voters to vote and the bar was comparable to vote by mail, yeah, uh-huh. Okay. Well, I think that's a like a open question in my mind about whether there is a possibility. Let's suppose this community was able to make the research, you know, breakthrough advances to be able to come up with something that people would feel comfortable enough for a narrow population. Could then it be deployed? I'm not ready to. Maybe you know better than I do about the difficulties of doing that. Yeah. Yes.
Carson had recently had election officials from Egypt visit us.
Mm-hmm.
They have nearly as many overseas voters as Americans, and they're desperate to get them to vote.
Wow.
That's another one US angle. I like the idea of making all UK voters sign a privacy waiver.
All right. So if we accept, if we were to accept for the moment that we're targeting this kind of overseas voters, and that that we don't need the level of polling place comparable to the polling anonymity comparable to what you get at the polling place, and then it suggests, you know, sort of like a simple, trivial modification to the make everything public regime, which is I still put all the votes up on a, on this public site, but instead of putting people's names, I give them a tracking number. Just like when you send a FedEx or something. And so when you vote, you get your you get a tracking number, and then you can go look up on the website and see that your tracking number appears and that the votes show up on that website next to your tracking number the way you cast them. And then after the election, anyone can tabulate all the votes. And the privacy guarantees we get are, well, the election official knows what tracking number they gave you, so if the election official wanted to tell how you vote, then presumably they could. This system doesn't prevent that. But you know, let's be realistic, right? Election officials are not out to try to look at how you vote. It's sort of like, you know, when I go to the doctor and I disrobe in front of the doctor, right? He's seen 1,000 other people before me and he's like so bored. You know, maybe this is an acceptable level of privacy that many voters would be willing to be comfortable with. So, problem solved?
No.
What do you think?
You don't know that the same tracking number hasn't been given out twice, for example.
Okay. Uh-huh.
Some of them correspond to dead people.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
At least in Colorado, we have to wait for the court case that's currently pending in center, where the election officials actually accosted voters after the fact.
Yeah. Yep. There may be opportunities. Yeah, that's right. I like the way you're thinking. Though, you know, Ron, that was a technical problem, and I bet we might be able to come up with technical solutions to that, like publishing a list of the voters who voted separately, randomized order, and then we can count how many tracking numbers appear on this and how many voters' names appear, and if those two should total. Yep. Okay. All right. Yes. We with authenticating the voter doesn't help at all. That is a totally orthogonal issue. Using some kind of system like this, you'd need a way to authenticate voters, and that's at least in this straw man system would be something totally separate. Probably today. Let me set aside how you do voter authentication, because the question of voter authentication for remote voting is a great problem area, too. I think it's probably separable.
There is a detailed proposal called Remotegrity, which is based in part on this. It's also a hybrid system. What are your thoughts on that system?
Let me come back to that. The short version is Remotegrity is cool. But my worry is that it goes too far on security and not far enough on usability, that the big challenge here is usability. And I would love to see a study of how usable Remotegrity is, but I fear that it's going to be not even in the ballpark.
There was a version of it that was used in Tacoma Park successfully.
Okay. Okay, so problem. So, okay, if we address a few little details, are we done?
I'm skeptical still of this idea that you can say that it's only for overseas voters.
Yeah.
Because it's extremely hard to tell when somebody says they want to use it, whether or not they're in our overseas. And if you think about the definition of who would be eligible, you couldn't even actually be the people who were overseas at the time they were applying. It would have to be something like the set of people who, a few weeks in advance of the election, declared their expectation that they were going to be overseas at the time of the election. And how are you going to figure out who's truthfully in that category?
You have to be, I think, even more pragmatic than that. To put a system in place where you say, this is just for one small class of voters, you have to realise what's going to happen. That 3 or 4 years down the line, your electoral officials are going to say, that worked really well. We saved all this paper and all this messing about. Let's just expand it to the whole electorate. I'm very wary of anything that proposes an easy way to vote for an easy but not very happy way to vote for a small section of the community, because quickly, it will just become for everybody, and we won't be able to stop the train by that point.
One way to think about that is, presumably the system you're talking about is less perfect than, say, polling place precinct voting in person. It's not as secure, it's not as something. And so the idea is to express those costs so people who choose this realize they're getting a less valuable vote. They're getting a worse product. So it's easier, maybe,
wow, we got lots of interest here. Okay, Duncan, then Pam, then Justin.
First of all, I think there are going to be two different sides to this in the United States, at least with now, I think, more than 2 million lawyers in 50 states. Some state somewhere will have a regulation or a law that says that if it's available as a voting right for one population, it has to be extensible to the rest of the population. Some state, I don't know which one, but some lawyer is going to find that argument or file suit. And the flip side is if you say, yes, but we're forcing people to vote in a less acceptable way, some other lawyer is going to sue to reject that on the basis that it will disenfranchise the people who get the good system. That's a practical issue with lawyers, but I think that's going to be a huge issue somewhere.
Justin?
Pam? Aware of, we certainly
I hear you. Let me push back just as gently a little tiny bit, Pam.
Go for it.
MOVE Act 2012. This survey was of voters in the 2012 November election, 25%, right?
Yeah.
So. Yep.
So that's a big deal.
Yep.
So I think what Pam said needs amplification. The fact that the secret ballot is a benefit, that your secrecy is a benefit to me and my secrecy is a benefit to you, destroys the economic argument. Because if, in fact, a decrease in secrecy increases the value of my vote in the marketplace, in the illegal marketplace, votes. So if we have a system where I could sign a waiver of privacy that would permit me to sell my vote, for example, if my ballot had a sequence number on it that was going to be published on a bulletin board, that's a tremendous value to the class of voters interested in selling their votes.
Good. Thank you, Doug. That was a technical analysis. This is what I was hoping for. I was hoping to show you there's some meat, technical meat in this too, not just policy. And I think one thing I just heard from what you said is, hey, one problem with the scheme I just showed you is it's coercible. I can prove how I voted. Am I correctly hearing what you said? Yes. Yes, you are right. Yes. All right. Yes.
So
another comment.
Just kind of following up on some of the points that we've heard about, voters will like this and election officials will like this, and eventually there will be kind of this mission creep. One of the challenges here is that people are kind of notoriously bad at figuring out whether they're getting a good product or a bad product. I mean, like, there are even studies that show that people can't even tell if their doctor is giving them good advice or bad advice, and a lot of malpractice suits are because, more of the bedside manner of the doctor than anything else. And so if we're going to move forward with internet voting, we need very solid, or any new voting system, really solid criteria on, ahead of time of, what is it going to mean to be secure? What is it going to mean to be accessible? What is it going to mean for this to actually be a good system that we can use either for overseas voters or in-person voters or whomever, and stick to those criteria and kind of understand the reasoning behind having those criteria in the first place. So 3 years down the line, when the voters say, well, we want this for everyone because it's fantastic and we love it. Well, it's great that you love it, but, does it actually meet these other criteria that we set out ahead of time?
Thank you. Yes. So that would be a great, technical challenge as well to take on, I think, for us to start trying to figure out what ought the requirements to be and how do we evaluate or measure the security level and what do we think is a, a reasonable security level given the risks. By the way, so let me just come back to some of this technical stuff. One of the hints that I was hoping to land to you was that this scheme that I just so confidently stated problem solved, I also wanted to convey to you that I think there's some technical depth to this problem too, because you see, this alone isn't enough. There's some issues here. And let me tell you about some of the issues. And Doug has spotted one in coercion, and we could have a fun conversation about coercion, but maybe we should wait for the presentation on coercion before we have that conversation. But there's another little, there's several more challenges here that are non-trivial, I think. One more challenge is, you let me get away with this claim that this provided privacy, but you shouldn't have, because there's a problem here. There's a problem with this. See, it's not actually going to be vanilla or chocolate or vanilla, but the vote is actually going to be, at least for in the U.S., it's going to be a list of all of your votes and all of the contests and dozens of contests potentially. And, there's maybe hundreds or thousands or more ballot styles across an entire county. And if Alice is an overseas voter and she's the only one who gets that particular ballot style, which is not at all unusual to imagine given the number of ballot styles and the number of overseas voters, then she has no privacy because, you see, it's basically a public record where Alice's, lives and Alice's home precinct is, and thus what ballot style Alice got. And so if there's only one vote on this entire public website that matches that ballot style, that's Alice's. And it doesn't matter that her name isn't on there. We can figure out how she voted. All right? What's that? So that's a coercion. Yes, that's a coercion risk. But even if we set aside coercion, even if we were to say, coercion, I'm not going to try to solve the coercion problem, we have a more basic privacy problem here, which is, so for instance, I did a little simulation with some data I have from one county. My data suggests that if we estimate that overseas voters were randomly distributed in a proportion corresponding to their proportion in the overall U.S. population, then something like 4% of the overseas voters would be uniquely identified by this, and something like 28% of them would have an anonymity set of less than 20, meaning you could narrow down their vote to one of 20 possibilities. Now, maybe anonymity set of 20 isn't so bad, but this suggests at least there'd be some voters who would not have privacy. You shouldn't have let me get away with this claim. There's actually something to do here to try to figure out whether this meets our privacy goals. And just to try to get you interested in thinking about, you know, the computer science behind this, let me suggest a direction that I've been thinking about. Maybe you'll have a better direction. The first thing that comes to mind for me is if one tracking number isn't safe for privacy, well, let's try two, right? Why not? I mean, so we could split up Alice's vote. We could split up every voter's vote into like two pieces or something. And give Alice, you know, two tracking numbers, one tracking number for the first half of the contest on her ballot and another tracking number for the second half. Or it doesn't have to be the first half, second half. It could be federal, state, or you could try to pick any division that, you know, provides as much privacy as possible. Does it work? Well, I did another one of these little simulations on a couple of counties that I have some data for, and one county I could find a split that ensured that all but 5% of the voters had an anonymity set of 20 or larger. Another one, 100% of the voters would have an anonymity set of size 20 or larger. So it's not perfect, but it looks like maybe it helps, and it looks like maybe that's possible to do something like this that might solve the privacy issue, but it's not trivial. You shouldn't let me get away with this. Okay, so I just wanted to show you an example scheme. I'd love your thoughts about how we could make this better, how we could make this work. Would it actually be workable for users? How do we choose these kind of splits in a way to minimize the number of tracking numbers we have to give to voters? There's a bunch of challenges here, but I just wanted to give you a taste to feel like maybe it's possible. Maybe it's possible to come up with a solution here that would be good enough. That we're not, this is not a teleporter. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, this is a general case of against the pattern voting kind of possibility. Many people argue that all ballots should be split in this way. You should never publish the vector of everybody's vote and so on.
Uh-huh.
And that does solve one problem, but that creates as many problems, or many other problems as well. There's valuable information in those vectors for officials designing districts and for voters trying to organize politically and for analysts trying to do research for various kinds. So there's no free lunch.
Yeah. And just to try to make the argument as well that there's hope, I mean, I think the other obvious direction that I'm surprised none of you have called me on yet is the obvious potential approach is to try to use some kind of end-to-end open audit cryptographic scheme. And I think that's very promising as well. I'm a little worried about the level of complexity in some of these schemes. And I think that gets to this comment we heard earlier, which is I think a major challenge for us is how do we evaluate these schemes? How do we, like, given the level of complexity, how do we certify that one of these schemes meets all our goals? But also very promising. And there's other promising approaches too. For instance, I'd point you to Juan Gilbert's very cool stuff on remotely supervised remote voting, which doesn't solve all the problems with remote voting, but may help with some of the challenges due to the fact that it's currently remote voting is unsupervised. There's no poll worker present. He suggests, hey, we got technology. Maybe we could have a poll worker remotely supervise things. Okay, so the argument I'm trying to make is this is important and there might be hope. Okay, but some caveats. First of all, the big caveat that I want to get at is usability. I feel like usability is so important here. And it'd be very easy for us as a community to go down a direction where we build systems that are not actually useful because they're not usable. And those of you who were here, I guess it was last year, heard Dana make the argument that if it's not usable, it's not secure, and I'm 100% behind that. So I feel like our number one challenge for making systems that work is to make systems that are usable. And I would take usability over auditability and auditability over security. Okay. So I think we have to be careful not to go down the path that adds cryptographic layer on top of cryptographic layer on top of cryptographic layer if the implication is that now there's 17 codes that the voter has to know what to do with and make sense of. And okay. So yes, keep it simple, stupid. All right. And the other caveat that I want to throw out there that I would love to see more discussion of is, as far as I can tell, my summary of the current state of the art is we don't know how to build a secure bulletin board. We don't know how to build a public website that has all the features we really need from it. And every end-to-end cryptographic voting system out there assumes that we know how to build public bulletin boards. And the scheme I just showed you assumes we know how to build a public bulletin board. And I don't know how to build one that I would really feel fully confident in. Okay? So let me give you some examples of why, to give you, try to, like, if this is not obvious. Maybe this is obvious to many of you who've studied this issue. But suppose that 20% of voters verify their vote against the public website right after they vote. Check that their vote was recorded correctly. Now, we'd like to say, well, hey, that's great. That's good enough. You know, the 20%, if the system is, you know, going systematically going wrong left and right, then, you know, a lot of people are going to notice it, and it doesn't need to be 100%. 20% should be fine. But there's a problem here. That's actually no good at all, potentially, in the worst case. If we'd like our voting system, if we'd like to get some auditability to verify the voting system counted our votes correctly, even if it was hacked or compromised. If that public website is hacked and controlled by a bad guy, the attacker can change everyone's votes and can change everyone's votes after voters verify them, but before they're counted. If voters are verifying their vote right after they cast it, then the website can show them what they expect when they verify right at the beginning, and then later show the tally or something else when they go to tabulate the election. Under some assumptions here, which I think are plausible, like that probably the time when it's most salient for most voters to go verify their vote is right during or after they cast it, not at some undetermined point later. Yes, Josh, you want to
beat me up?
This public website can digitally sign as many lists as you want. So when Alice goes to verify her vote, it sends her one signed one.
I have two different digital signatures.
How are you going to get two different digital signatures?
If I have two different lists.
Yeah, I knew you were going to give me this grief. So I even prepared this for you, Josh. So I knew this was coming. Thank you. Right, okay, so your immediate response is, well, Dave, that's lame, right? You said that all the voters did was they just checked right after they vote, but there should be at least some people who check after they vote and then continue to check later to make sure that it hasn't been changed, and maybe, yes, crypto geeks can go do that. That's another question, whether the voting system even allows voters to go check their vote. But if we imagine a hypothetical voting system where voters could check their vote at any time they wanted, and even if we imagine some hypothetical crypto geeks like me and Josh and everyone else in this room, we go like check, 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 check like crazy. We check right after we voted, and we check again the next day, and we check right before election day, we check after election day, and we make sure that they're all the same. It's still not good enough. It's still not good enough, and there's a very kind of specific technical reason here, which is the public website, the voting system, knows who you are. When you go to vote, you have to tell it who you are. You have to authenticate who you are. It knows who you are. It knows it's me, or it knows it's Josh, and, you know, if the attackers are smart, they're going to go look and see who's checking, and if it's me or Josh, they're going to, you know, make sure that they're voting, that the system behaves correctly. And what's that?
This is an easily solved problem, but when you're actually here, it just isn't going to be a problem.
Okay.
It's a hash of the entire file of voters' votes. And when you check your vote, you check the hash against the entire thing, or at least there's a Hurdle tree or whatever. And then you just check your own vote. This is easily.
And then what? And then what? When Alice checks, she gets a totally different hash and a totally different view. Oh, it's detectable in principle, but will it actually be detected is my question. So what does Alice have to do, Alice, the not a crypto geek? What do we have to tell her to do to check her vote?
There's a fraction you have to check in order to check a certain amount of fraud. It's going to be like 1/11 margin or something like that. So you need to have that many votes.
I think this is much harder, Ron. I would like to hear the specification of what Alice the average voter should do, or if it's not Alice the average voter, if it's us, you know, knowledgeable technical experts, I would be okay with that, except for this problem here that the voting system could know who us technical experts are and not, you know, not cheat.
Has to commit to the pile of votes, or publicly in the New York Times, wherever else, there's a hash value for the entire election pile of votes.
Right. Right. So your hypothesis, so let me just walk through what you're saying. For Alice, the average voter, to check her vote, we need to tell her to go get a New York Times and check, not online, in paper, and check the hash that she got from a website against the newspaper, right?
There is one or many apps that are written by geeks among us. And the app says, download, check the hash, check your vote, post the signed list on some independent site, so that it can also be checked if two people ever get different lists with the same signature. There's a very high probability they will appear somewhere else in the site.
Or just the Democratic Party and the Republican Party check their lists, and if they're getting different hash values, then there's a problem. And they should have the same total. I don't think this is a hard problem.
So, way back at the first PBT, we put out this data diodes idea, which is certainly not a new invention, but it allows the data stream between the election management system and the bulletin board to be wiretapped anonymously by independent observers who independently capture a copy of that data stream and independently compute results and independently allow examination of the content. It's not crypto at all, but it does address this issue by providing the possibility of basically completely independent election results presentation. And now you have to attack 10 websites instead of just one website. It doesn't solve the problem, but it does increase the difficulty of attacking.
Yeah, so I guess I'm willing, if you believe it's solvable, okay, I'll believe it. I'd love to see a specification of how to do it and a usability test whether an average voter can follow the procedure. And just to sharpen this, you know, criticism a little more, right, I'm not sure that our current analyses really take into account the fact that the bulletin board knows who every single person is. So if I imagine an app, and some people are going to check and some people are not, and some are going to use the app and some are going to use the web system, you know, now start from the assumption that the voting system, the public website, knows who you are and knows whether you're going to use that app or not, knows whether you're going to check or not. Then is the system still secure? I'm not so sure that it's so easy to defend against that. And if you push back on that assumption, I would say it's very hard for me to imagine how I would build a public bulletin board where I could have confidence that it can't predict anything about who I am, given the myriad number of ways to track people on the web. So I don't know. I'd be happy to be convinced otherwise. That would be great. I would be so happy if this bulletin board problem is solved. Okay. Yep.
I don't see why the bulletin board needs to know who you are when you're looking at it. Kind of give you all the information that it's got, and they do check for your particular button.
Yeah. So my first thought to manage this issue was, well, you know, the bulletin board should be accessible to anyone. You don't actually tell the bulletin board who you are. But I don't think that actually works, because the bulletin board and the voting system, they're, you know, a related system. And I log into the voting system and I tell the voting system who I am. And there's so many ways to track you online that for all I know, it could be recording some, you know, unique browser fingerprint of my browser that then when I go visit the bulletin board, it can, you know, link that to the information about who I am that it already has. So I think...
The key point here is you need public commitment to the entire collection of votes. Mm-hmm. The point of an election audit or whatever, the descriptive voting system, is to convince the losers they lost legitimately.
Yep.
You need to be able to give the officials running the losers, candidates, a hash of the entire election things. And then anybody who voted for that fellow who lost can check in the copy of the database that was committed to and given to the losing candidate. This is a solid involved data.
Okay. All right. And I'll just mention my one more wish list. One more wish list I have is that voters who want to confirm their vote should be able to do it right away, and that should count. We shouldn't have to demand that they have to come back, you know, 2 weeks later after the election is over. That's an interesting point. Yeah, that's an interesting challenge. Yeah, that's a good point. So in the scheme that I just described, it has this unfortunate property that it reveals running tallies before election day is over. Maybe that's unacceptable. Yep.
So there's one way in the world that's on the world that I think the voting system that actually gives you the information, but it doesn't force you to come back and change it. That's the Norwegian system.
And that's?
The Norwegian system.
Yes. 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 Okay, I think I should move on and wrap up. So Ron says the answer to this question is yes, so that's great. So the big question that I have is, can we make it safe enough? Can we make internet voting safe enough for overseas military disabled voters? Can we make it both audible and usable? And by the way, I think we need a whole lot more work on usability. I would love to see future voting system designs do a little bit of a usability test. I've learned just how easy it is to do usability tests with lo-fi prototypes with pieces of paper, and you get five people, and you'd be amazed by the amount of insight you'll get by a half a day or a day of testing with pieces of paper, Wizard of Oz, and five people. Will voters be able to audit their votes? Will they actually do it? I would love to see some analysis on that. So let me just sum up the message I had for you today. I was hoping to stimulate some discussion, and I hope that I will stimulate more. Let me just try to be clear about what I'm saying. Am I saying I know how to make internet voting safe today? No, I'm not. I think that's clear. Am I saying we should deploy internet voting today? No, please don't. What I'm saying is, I would love to see this research community make a massive effort to try to figure out how to make it safe. See what we can do if we can make it possible. We have to try. Thank you.
So we have plenty of time for questions, so please. Fire away.
Great talk, David. So, part of the what answers you get depends on which questions you ask, of course. And you're asking the question here: how do we make internet voting better? The problem you're trying to solve is remote voting, of course, and that's internet voting is just a potential means to that end. The real question is how to make remote voting work better. And one answer that's often dismissed or not considered is proxy voting, and I would love to see that continually raise. It's no worse than many of the solutions that you're talking about here. And some countries do use it, where you're allowed to collect maybe up to 4 proxies for people who are remote, family members or trusted, and they vote for you. So I think that is, in terms of your usability versus auditability versus security, that's highly usable. You know, you just talk to your friend, and they're going to vote for you, and so on, too. And so if you're looking for a remote voting solution that's highly usable, I think it's to be recommended. It doesn't have auditability and other properties built into it, of course, if you have to have a auditable scheme at the bottom if you're going to make it auditable. But it's something that's worth discussing. And I just want to make sure that's on the table.
Yeah, amen. I'm sorry, I forgot. I totally agree.
Hi, Bill Edelstein. So I'm a physicist, so this isn't normally my field. But one of the things that... where it would be interesting to apply this, where we already have tons of remote voting, is voting for company stocks. And also, maybe somebody solved this, and also voting for private organizations. Like, I belong to the American Physical Society, which has 50,000 members who are scattered all over the world, so they have to do it remotely. And so what do they do now? They hire a company. There are like 20 companies. They hire this company, and you have no idea, you know, whether they're telling you the truth. You have no idea in the end whether when you vote for the president of the American Physical Society, who isn't. You may think this is trivial, but what if, you know, one person has a view on climate change that you don't like or something like that, and the people who are in charge decide they're going to have the other guy elected. And by the way, I've talk to them before, and I say, and they won't even tell you the vote. They say, oh, no, we're not going to tell you the vote because then the people who lost might be sad, believe it or not. So but this is a problem that is sort of intermediate in that you probably could. I mean, I've thought of your idea of the numbers and the, you know, somewhat reduced anonymity, and maybe this could be applied. So this is, I think, a very important area. Especially, I mean, voting for companies, you think that you'd like to have something secure, but it's, again, nobody knows whether the results are true. So that's another research area. Thanks. Bye.
And to back that up, I'm still fascinated why we vote in the IEEE, the ACM, using an outsourced election system. Aren't those the first place that we should be trying this sort of thing? But besides that, earlier I heard all these arguments about it's a slippery slope. We can't work on this because then people are going to want to vote remotely because they're kids, and election officials are going to want to push things. I'm sorry, but we're already way down that slope because, you know, we have companies like Everybody Counts and like Seidel and folks like that whom we might like, but, you know, they're building systems already. They're being purchased for large piles of money. So maybe we should try to do something to help things out. So I'm on board with you, David. High five. Let's go have a beer.
So I'm going to ask the obvious question from the A2A crowd, which is, you know that there's already a pile of literature and example systems like Helios already out there, right? And I accept your criticism that a lot of it isn't very usable. Fair enough, okay. My question to you is, how is your objective different from the objective of that literature? Is it just that you consider usability to be more important, or do you have a different aim?
It's not different at all, I think. I think we have the same aims. I think of that line of work as maybe the most promising, you know, kind of angle to come up with something that might actually solve the problem for overseas voters. And Helios is, you know, a brilliant stake in the ground. So I guess, yeah, maybe where could we improve? The two that I see that I worry a little bit about, or where I think there might be opportunities for improvement, usability. And the other one is thinking about how we can design a voting system that voters can understand and election officials can understand, and we can certify and that we can evaluate. I've never looked at the code of Helios. I don't know how many people here have looked at the code of Helios. I need to look at the code of something to be confident in the Helios. I have to believe someone built a verifier app, or I have to understand how to build one, or I have to look at the code of that. How do election officials, how does the certification process certify those systems? Maybe it's doable. That'd be the second one where, you know, I'd love to think how we could, what's the best we can do?
I'm Susanna Goodman from Common Cause, and we filed a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission about some of the security claims of some of the internet voting systems vendors, because there's just no bar. There's no bar. That's something that this community hopefully can pressure the FTC to look into, because the claims that vendors can make are outrageous, completely we think they're unsubstantiated. There's no publicly reviewable evidence for a lot of these claims. And election officials who are under extraordinary pressure to help overseas and military voters, et cetera, are getting, are just want these systems so badly to work. Call David Vladek at the FTC and tell him to take up this claim.
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute, not to say that I agree with anything I'm about to say. There are states like my home state of Virginia who want this so badly and recognize that this being internet voting, and recognize that none of the products are good enough and there's no certification and yada yada, so they decide they're going to roll their own, because certainly if they can run their state website, they can do internet voting. Mm-hmm. How do we help them understand that maybe just going full steam ahead isn't the right thing, and that they don't mistakenly understand this argument to be an argument for going ahead? I mean, you said we shouldn't do it, but they don't hear that part. They hear the other part. We need to do this.
I don't know how to have that conversation without saying it over and over again to try to draw this distinction. But I feel like the problem is this is a problem where technical advances could have a big impact.
Well, yeah. I'm sorry, just to follow up 1 second, yeah. The argument in Virginia, which is the same argument we've heard in some other states, is it's not internet voting, it's returning your ballot using email.
Yeah.
Just the way you return your ballot using the postal service, and the postal service isn't a voting system, therefore,
send the people from Virginia to South Carolina. We're now into a $50 million backfill because of the data breach from the revenue. 15 years of all of the tax records for everybody who ever filed in South Carolina went to the Ukraine.
So Jeremy, can I follow up on that a little more? Can I just expand on this a little bit? Let me share you a perspective. I feel like this community has been enormously successful at getting out the message. It took us maybe 10 years, but in the grand scheme of things, the community has been very successful at getting out the message that internet voting is really scary, and it is. So, you know, I understand why we're worried about undermining that message, but I feel like the high-level bit, first of all, is that we have been successful at getting out that message, and you know, many election officials I've talked to have heard that and understand it and are on board with it, right? So how do we move from there? I guess the part that inspires me personally is I can find it very easy to become discouraged if I think about the political or the other challenges. And I feel like where we have a special, you know, we have a secret sauce. We have a magic cape, right? We can, like, where we as a community, research community can become Superman and be the hero is that we can invent new technology, we can invent better schemes. And so that, I guess, is where the perspective I'm coming from and what I'm arguing for is, let's go into our bat cave, even if we don't, if we have to like not tell anyone outside our research community that we're working on this problem, I'm fine with that. But let's, you know, let's try and solve this thing. Okay, I didn't do enough to stimulate controversy. Thank you all.